Welcome to the September issue of the Oldie Podcast. In our podcast, Time with each issue, we like to include a feature, as well as an interview with a regular columnist. They don't get much more regular than the Oldie's long-serving contributor, Virginia Ironside, who's been part of the Oldie Ensemble from as far back as I can read in the archive issues. She's a columnist, novelist, and Agni aunt. She's also dabbled in stand-up comedy, taking her show Growing Old Disgracefully to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival 3 times. Agni aunt is a role she has occupied between multifarious titles for 40 years, a weighty burden you might think. In the Oldie, she has answered reader conundrums from how to deal with an ex-friend who is a pain, to problems with portion size amongst the youngsters, and a husband who's obsessed with the First World War. Virginia doesn't suffer fools gladly. She doles out acerbic, no-nonsense responses to reader questions, but can also offer a great deal of compassion when due, like in a recent column when she wrote a heartfelt answer to a reader who couldn't understand why she hadn't cried after the death of a much-loved parent. So, first off, Virginia, does being an Agni aunt feel like a great responsibility, or is it something you wear lightly and dispense answers with a pinch of salt?
I don't dispense answers with a pinch of salt at all. And yet I don't feel I've got a great responsibility, because I had said it just comes very, very easily to me, so that any problem I'm given, I can just see a way out, or, I mean, it may not be the way out or a way out that works, but I can always glibly come up with an answer, and I don't know where that comes from, and I've very rarely been stumped by any problem that's come up. It always seems to me glaringly obvious. Like, do you remember those pictures, maybe not when you were young, but in magazines they used to have for children, spot the hidden goblin in a wood, and there'd be a drawing of a goblin disguised in the wood somewhere. And I would never be able to spot this goblin. You'd have to turn the picture around. But it's rather like that with the answers. I can just spot the goblin at once. Just leaps out at me.
Gosh, sort of, I feel like my equivalent was Where's Wally?
Yeah, Where's Wally? Of course, absolutely, yes. I prefer Spot the Goblin.
I think I prefer
that. Yes.
For a long period under Alexander Chancellor, the former editor of the Oldie, you were a straight-up columnist and you had a whole page. Did you feel like you were coming home when Harry took over editorship and you could resume your Agni aunt title and responsibilities?
Well, it was a mixed feeling, really, because I actually wasn't being an Agni aunt at the time that Harry came to the scene, and I just lost my job on The Independent because it had gone bust. Mm-hmm. And so I missed that proper role of being an Agni aunt, and so it was great to be able to continue almost seamlessly from The Independent to The Oldie and not have to say I used to be an Agni aunt. On the other hand, I really enjoyed doing the column because I do enjoy being funny. I mean, if I was funny, I hope I was, but it comes very naturally to me as well. And often I'll get things will happen to me and I think, oh God, I wish I had a column that I could put that into.
I like that being an Agni aunt has been a continual flow. So from The Independent and then that came to an end, but then actually, luckily, it continued into the old end. Do you feel that if...
Yes, I feel like Buster Keaton or Charlie Chaplin on one of those scaffolding in those old films, you know, he's just about to step off into the unknown when another plank comes on and he goes
my
on.
Goodness.
All, like, the, yes, Sweepy and Popeye. Do you remember the little... So again, you wouldn't remember, but the little baby was always in dangerous situations. So there'd always be something, a bucket to fall into that would then tip her onto.
If you meet someone for the first time and it comes into the conversation that you're an Agni aunt, are they quick to present a problem to you? Does it become a bit boring and predictable?
The conversation always becomes boring and predictable, but unfortunately not, because they present a problem. That would be really interesting.
Oh.
No, they always say, oh, how did you get started? Do you invent the questions? Do you have to... Have you ever had one that you couldn't... And the questions are so predictable, I feel I really ought to hand them a sheet and just say, no, these are the answers. Could you tell me a problem there? That's what I want. That's what I'm after. I'm like a gold digger looking for gold dust. Just please be unhappy. Please.
Are letters harder to reply to when they come from anonymous? Do you like to be able to envisage the reader? Do you carry the reader's problems around with you?
It doesn't make any difference whether they're anonymous or not, because Henry Bloggins is just as anonymous to me as an anonymous letter. Letters are very rare these days, of course. They're mainly emails, and that's a shame because you miss the handwriting.
Mm.
And the handwriting is quite a giveaway in some way. You can tell whether people are shy or outgoing or up to a point that a personality does come through their hand. However, I only get emails now. And no, it doesn't make any difference whether they're anonymous or not. And I do reply to them all. I've just been doing it just now. Mm.
Do you carry the reader's problems around with you? Do you sit on a problem, or is it, as you said, the goblin is glaring through the woods and immediately you feel like I need to solve this?
There have been the odd problem which has touched me greatly, and it always involves children or grandchildren. Anyone who used to write, they don't do it now, saying that their son is being abused or their husband is hitting them or the child. Why this? No, that's my cat.
Virginia's cat mewing for his lunch.
There was one recently from a man whose son had died, and the daughter-in-law had just whisked the grandchildren away abroad and obviously resolved never to see the grandparents again, and I still feel upset about that. I've that loss of children or grandchildren or cruelty to children or neglect is very difficult not to strike a chord.
Do you have a favourite Agni Aunt from another publication?
The Agni Aunts I respect most are the ones who answer every letter and email that comes in. And Deirdre Sanders, as far as I know, is the only one on the Sun who does that. She has a team. And I think it's actually immoral and wicked not to answer people's problems. If you're setting us up as an Agni Aunt to trade in misery and not to bother about those people who write in who are unhappy, and it's extraordinary how little you need say, just I hear you and I feel so sorry and have you done this, or it doesn't take very long. But most Agni Aunts these days do not answer all the problems, and I actually think it's shameful. It doesn't matter how good their advice is. I do like Graham Norton. I think he's in the Telegraph now, I'm not sure, and I don't know if he answers all problems. But I'm afraid, really, the only one who's worthy of any respect is Deirdre. Mm. Much as I like the others, and they find their replies fun, but it's just not right.
Have you ever fallen out with an editor over whether or not a problem can be printed?
Some problems in the past have gone a bit far, and certainly in the early days, people were slightly worried about talking about certain types of sex. I mean, anal sex perhaps wouldn't have gone down very well in the early 70s, etc. But I think now, on the whole, anything goes. Although Harry removed something recently, didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he's right. I mean, I was born to be young in the 60s. I'm 74, but people older than me might well find various bits of sexual activity slightly nauseating. And so I think probably he was right not to go too far.
Mm. Do you think the serious, informative Agony Aunt column still has a place in the world of internet chat rooms and Google? When you type a problem into Google, you're besieged with answers and articles on a topic. Or do you think that there's greater need than ever for validated answers in the authority of print?
I don't think the authority of print has much to do with it, but there is something very nice about you, yourself, me, whatever, being answered by someone with a picture in a paper who is an authority figure, whatever you think about it.
I completely agree.
And I, of course, I go on chat rooms when I have problems, and particularly medical problems, and it's jolly nice to read of everybody's different experiences. But in the end, if I have got a medical problem, I want to go to a doctor and I want him to look at me and say, you are all right, or this is what you've got. So that personal directness is very important.
Now, a few issues that I would like to get your thoughts on. Celebrity Agony Aunts. Yes or no? I believe that the Spice Girls once dabbled in the art forms, then Paula Yates and also Vanessa Feltz. Do you think that there is room for this type of Agony Aunt?
Well, of course there's room for them. And you know, basically, an Agony Aunt is just another means of selling papers, and if it, or magazines. So if it works, it works, as long as they're answering them all behind the scenes. Vanessa Feltz, I think, is rather good. Or was, I can't remember if she's doing it now. But a lot of celebrity agony aunts, I don't think, actually write the column. I mean, they get somebody to write it for them. I don't think, really, the best agony aunts are journalists, really, because they do know what problems make a story. I mean, Deirdre Sanders always says the agony column is the signpost to the service. And so she's the, you know, the neon, sexy front to what is a very, very good service, which she carries out behind the scenes. But she does know, because she's a journalist, what should be at the top, what should be at the bottom, whether she's done it last week, whether... I mean, if one represented one's postbag as a whole, it would just be a gloom and loneliness from dawn to dusk. So I do think celebrities, I think they know how to be celebrities and be funny or clever or act well, but I don't think they've got a clue about problems. In fact, slightly less of a clue than most people, because they live in a slightly unreal world. But the other people who are useless as being agony aunts are counsellors, because, of course, they have no idea about how to write. And it's always been tried. Oh, yes, let's get an analyst or a counsellor to be an agony aunt. There's always, I can't tell from your letter exactly the situation, but I suggest you discuss it with your husband, and on the one hand, on the other. And I would advise you both go and see a counsellor. That's their only piece of advice. And that's no fun to read.
Yeah, it sounds horrible.
Maybe if you're in a situation, that might be quite a good thing to do, but you have got to make it readable, because you're a writer.
Mm-hmm. Another question for you. The right agony aunts become a lifeblood for readers. Do you think that is true or false?
There was some research done, but it was done years and years ago, which did show that the agony column and the horoscopes are the most read and most gone to parts of any publication. How true that is now, I don't know, but they're very seductive. But I think it's because the agony column particularly is, it's a comfort, as actually usually the horoscopes are. Even if it predicts gloom and doom, it's always, you know, but hang on in there, because something's going to change in the future. But the agony column is little, I always think of it, it's like seeing a crying child in a supermarket, and then suddenly its mother rushes down the aisle and picks it up and everybody's all right. So you've got a howl of pain in the agony column, and then a soothing and kindly comfort, an arm round you. And that's a nice thing for people to read. It makes them feel happy and that somebody's looking after somebody. That's what we're all looking for, me included, somebody to look after me, you know. And that's not because of my age, but because of, you know, who everybody is. One always wants somebody to
be kind. Yeah, it's comforting to read. Mm. And I suppose it's nice, some of the problems where you're obviously addressing one reader, but a lot of people might also have that, share that same problem.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So it's sort of the familiarity.
Yes.
What do you think of the faceless or fictional agony aunts? So I was thinking of the agony aunts that are that appear in a magazine as a cartoon, or whereas, so it's not, it's a made up name, as opposed to Virginia Ironside of the oldie, and so you know that you're a real person, you can Google you exist, whereas some people operate under a pseudonym.
I don't know that happens very much. I mean, there's Mrs. Mills in the Sunday Times, yeah. But that's a jokey column by a man, which is all to do with sex, basically. All agony aunts used to have fictitious names in the past. Evelyn Holm was the classic. Her real name was Peggy Makins, but Woman magazine decided when she was the agony aunt that her name didn't reflect womanhood. So they got a psychologist in and paid him to come up with the name Evelyn Holm. And the thinking behind it was that Evelyn is the a longer version of Eve, the temptress, in the Bible, and the first woman. Slightly different, Evelyn, to Eve, but still. And Holm summed up woman as homemaker, drudge, bottle washer, nappy changer. And they thought that with this combination of names, Evelyn and Holm, they'd got the archetypal woman. Well, actually, it doesn't feel like that at all to me. It just feels like an Amy Evelyn Holm. But that was their thinking behind it. And then Anna Raeburn came after Evelyn Holm, and she'd been doing the agony column at Forum magazine, which was a very sexy magazine, quite dirty. And she really blew the world of agony aunting apart, mentioning things like penises and vaginas and God knows what. And after that, everybody had their own names, as far as I know. There were a lot of invented names when I was young, but I don't think anymore.
I know that you have a son who I have read plays for the Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain.
He does,
which,
yes,
I think is fantastic.
Yeah, so do I.
Does he value the wisdom that you're able to proffer? Or does he say, as many boys or sort of people growing up do, like, oh, you know, be quiet, Mum?
What's so odd about him is that I used to find this with my own father. I find that I ask my son problems now, and he always delivers back to me exactly the answer that I would have given someone else. It's much easier for me not to think, what would I say in this situation, but to ask somebody else, and that he will always come back with a very good answer, because he sees, like me, straight to the problem. Mm-hmm. I remember my father ringing me up with a problem once, and I immediately thought, after the problem had been told to me, I wonder what my father would say if presented with this problem. And I, in my mind, I thought, what would he say? So I gave it back to my father, and I said, this is what I think you would say if I asked you. And he laughed, and he said, oh, of course, yes, you're quite right. So that's how it works.
A really nice way of thinking of it.
Yes.
What's the most obscure problem that's come your way that you can remember, or are you not able to reveal that?
I think the most difficult to answer, and terribly sad, and I hadn't realised at the time that it's actually a condition, was someone who wrote to me saying they were convinced they were dead and that they had been smothered by a pillow themselves. And they were absolutely certain they were dead, and their doctor said they weren't, they were alive, but they knew they were dead. And it was an awful life they were leading because they were, everybody seemed to think they were alive, but actually, of course, they knew they were dead. And it was a very difficult one. There wasn't the internet then where I could actually put it in there. It's a condition. It's like people who, body dysmorphia, who actually think that they look ugly when in fact they look good. And it's a very difficult one to dislodge somebody's mind about, and no amount of reassurance really gets anywhere. Now, I remember actually this was one of the disadvantages of having people to answer letters, which I did at Woman Magazine. And I had to read them all before they went out. There were so many then that I couldn't have done them all myself, but they were done by a team. But I read them all and signed them. And somebody wrote in saying that they were convinced they'd got cancer, absolutely certain of it. They'd had all the tests, they came back negative, they'd had nothing in their family, etc., etc., but they were obviously phobic. So this letter answerer, who was a slightly old lady, wrote back saying, "My dear, please don't worry. Everything's going to be fine because I can assure you that you don't have cancer. And I hope that reading this letter will make you feel better. However, one thing, do stop worrying, because if there's one sure way of getting cancer, it's by worrying about it." Well, you know, that sort of thing. You think, oh, crikey.
Oh, no.
There have been some howlers from the letter answer. One of them suggested to a lonely woman in London, she sort of went mad and she said, "I suggest you go down to the Bunch of Grapes, which is a pub in Knightsbridge, and just hang about there. And before you know where you are, some nice young man will come up to you and say he's got a spare ticket to the theatre." I just thought, what on earth is going on?
So, Virginia, how many years is it that you've been a columnist at The Oldie?
Well, I don't know.
The cat has now leapt behind the sofa.
And refuses to believe that she's been fed, which she has been. I don't know, actually. You say it's as far back as the archives, but it must be about 10 years, I suppose, because I think it was when my book first... I think it was when my first book came out. Not my first book, because I've been writing books ever since I was 20, actually. I've been publishing books. But the first book that made Richard Ingrams have a look at me and take me on was one in a series of funny books about being old. And the first one was called No, I Don't Want to Join a Book Club. And the second one was called No, I Don't Need Reading Glasses. And the third one was called Yes, I Can Manage, Thank You. And the last one was called No, I'm Quite Happy Standing. All of which total lies, of course. But anyway, that must have been when I was about 60. Yeah, so probably about 15 years, yes.
And did he invite you to join The Oldie as an agony aunt?
No, as a columnist. You're a columnist. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, they had an agony aunt at the time. I can't remember who it was. Mavis Nichols.
I see. And who is your favourite oldie columnist? Which page do you flick to first?
Oh, it's probably I love that his first column, that Matthew Norman's first column.
Grumpy old man.
I don't know if he can keep it up. I love Alice Pittman. I think she's extraordinarily good and maintains a really high standard. It's all the jokey ones, really. Giles Wood, I'm very fond of, partly because I know him, but partly because he writes very nicely. God, who else is there? Those are my
favourites.
Top favourites, yes.
You must have been to quite a few Oldie of the Year awards now, which is our annual celebration of Oldies who have done exceptionally well and are at a great age. Do any of the award ceremonies at Simpsons in the Strand or the winners stand out to you in particular?
The one I really loved was James Lovelock, who launched the Gaia theory a while ago. And he's about a million years old, and I know that in the last few years he's slightly, I'm not sure he's entirely, but reneged on his original idea. And I just thought that so brave to to really, that was his big thing, and then to say, I might have got it a bit wrong, was admirable. I think he's terrific.
Oh, I completely agree with you. And are there any oldies that you think deserve to be celebrated in future years? Or this year? Well, next year, 2019.
I'd love, and I've been longing for the past few years, to have Annie Nightingale nominated, the oldest DJ in town, I think. Or not in town, I think she's in Brighton. But she has her finger absolutely on the rock pulse. And she must be older than me, probably, well, certainly older than 74, which is what I am. And I think she really deserves an award. I think, actually, she might just be too trendy for the oldie. Isn't that an awful thing to say? But she really is...
Cutting edge.
Cutting edge, yes. Yeah. Much more cutting edge than me. She's terrific.
Finally, you worked on magazines from Vogue to Woman, and of course, the oldie. How do the cultures of these magazines differ?
I don't think you can really compare them at all because they were all at different times, different periods. So Vogue of then was very different to Vogue now. Woman then was very different to Woman now. And the oldie, of course, when I joined, was very different to how it is now under Richard. It did have a different feel to it. So I don't think I can compare those at all, no. Well, and also people are always saying our problems changed, and I just say misery is misery, whether you live in 12th century or 20th century. But it's always jolly nasty.
Well, Virginia, thank you so much for letting me come to your house. And I've absolutely loved it. I feel like the oldie needs to come to your house to profile it because it's covered in... beautiful artworks, some sculptures by Virginia and artworks by your uncle. It's wonderful. And also your cat.
Yes.
Has made his presence strongly felt.
Yes.
It's been a real treat. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.